This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Vicki Robin, a renowned innovator, writer, and speaker. Vicki has been at the forefront of the sustainable living movement and is co-author of the best-selling book, Your Money or Your Life. She has helped launch many sustainability initiatives, including the New Roadmap Foundation, the Simplicity Forum, Sustainable Seattle, the Center for a New American Dream, Transition Whidbey, and more. She has received awards from Co-op America and Sustainable Northwest and was a speaker on relational eating at TED Seattle. Vicki Robin is here today to tell us about her most recent book, Blessing the Hands That Feed Us, What Eating Closer to Home Can Teach Us About Food, Community, and Our Place on Earth, published in 2014. Welcome, Vicki.
Thank you, Diane.
What led you to write your book, Blessing the Hands That Feed Us?
It's sort of like a question about my whole life journey. We're not going to do all that, but as you know, I've been involved in sustainability for 20 years. And out of my work in that, my partner Joe Dominguez and I wrote Your Money or Your Life, which was a bestseller, and I worked for a decade on lowering consumption in North America. But actually, the one form of consumption that was off the table was eating, because my eating was not up for examination, because I'm a sport eater. And my feeling about eating and diet was really all about how can I adjust the size of my body so that I'm more acceptable socially? Or what can I and I can't eat in order to be healthier or more vibrant or have whiter eyes or whatever? You know, it's like they talk about yo-yo dieting. And I think it wasn't just the weight that yo-yoed, but it was yo-yoing between the type O diet. Oh, yes, should eat meat. No. John Robbins finding out about CAFOs and confined animal feeding operations. No, I shouldn't eat meat. So it was yo-yoing because I had no relationship with food, really. I mean, that whole realm was an unexamined realm of craziness where I was as woven into the ideas of the North American consumer culture as anybody. With Your Money or Your Life, I had examined my relationship with money and stuff. And I was naturally frugal, and I was completely consistent with my sustainability values. But in this area, I wasn't. So fast forward from that decade of working on Your Money, Your Life, and then in 2004, I was diagnosed with cancer. So I really resigned from the whole sustainability movement. But eventually, after several years, I went to a conference on peak oil. That got me in the presence of people who were talking about this whole other area of sustainability that I hadn't paid attention to. It wasn't the climate change piece. It was about resources and burning through the supply of what we have and getting to a point of constraint. And it just woke me up. And that's what got me onto what makes sense to me is relocalization. What makes sense to me is communities unhooking as much as possible from these global supply chains that are going to get disrupted. So I dove into that. As you said, I was part of Transition Whidbey. And from that, I became aware of how food insecure my little Whidbey Island is. And because of that, I was quite open to a challenge from a friend who is a farmer who said she was looking for somebody who for 30 days would simply eat what she could grow. And that led to the 10-mile diet, which led to the book.
What rules did you set for yourself for your month on a 10-mile diet?
The 10-mile diet started out as this partnership with a farmer. We agreed that I would do it in September 2010. We were both a little nervous about it because neither one of us was sure there was enough food coming out of her market garden. And then I realized, no, there's no cheese, there's no meat, there's no milk, there's no honey. And within my 10 miles, there's no grain, there's no beans. There's nothing to stick to the ribs here. So we agreed that since she was within 10 miles of my home, that we would do it in a 10-mile radius, and I could go out into my 10 miles as the crow flies. So that got me, if anybody knows Whidbey Island, it got me all the way north to north of Freeland, all the way south to just about midway in the ferry. And so I found beef, chicken, milk. That was an interesting thing because I discovered that raw milk is illegal and there was no processing plant on my 10 miles. So I found illegal raw milk and illegal goat cheese. And honey, I went into the grocery store. Somebody said to me, oh, well, that's no problem. 10-mile diet. Just go to the grocery store. I was like, no. I went in the grocery store and the only 10-mile food in my store was honey. So those were my rules. And I gave myself 4 exotics. I didn't want to live for a month without salt and a few other seasonings or oil or caffeine or lemons. So those are my 4 exotics. And I gave myself a pass on that.
What did you like the most about your 10-mile diet?
I liked a lot about it. I didn't like a lot about it, too, because, you know, number one, I had no nuts. I had no grains, so no crackers, no cookies, nothing to crunch on. That was really hard. I had no easy fast food. Everything was slow food because I had to cook it. I was only working with whole ingredients. And it excluded me, in a sense, from chowing down with everybody else in certain situations. But what I loved was the creativity, because I learned to cook not with recipes, but with ingredients. It was like, okay, I've got a turnip and a leek. Now what? And I discovered that a weed I'd been mowing in my yard was actually oregano. So I had 10-mile oregano, and my farmer, Tricia, would bring me some basil, and I had a little thyme. So I started learning to take just a few ingredients that were available to me and make them into something yummy. But the most important thing for me was this experience of belonging, that eating is an act of belonging. It locates you someplace on earth. I sort of landed somewhere in a real community, not just of people or buildings, but of soil. And that sense of being in relationship, I call relational eating. That was the big aha that changed me.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Vicki Robin, author of the book Blessing the Hands That Feed Us, What Eating Closer to Home Can Teach Us About Food, Community, and Our Place on Earth. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Well, you brought up relational eating. What is relational eating? Would you say more?
Yeah, it's a term that I coined to describe an experience I was having. And it's the experience of the shift from being what I call an anywhere, anytime, anything eater in a global, industrial, corporate food system where every flavor in the world is available to you if you have money. It's like a vast food court. So we treat the food system like a vending machine. We don't have to think about where it comes from, how it gets to the store. We don't have to think about what's in the packages. All we have to think about is going to the store or the restaurant and getting food. Somebody told me in New York now that people eat so much takeout food that when one family reports that the kids know it's dinner time because the doorbell rings. So we don't have any relationship with the food that we eat. And it passes very quickly through our bodies. We don't have any relationship with what comes out. We take no responsibility for that. 40% of the food worldwide is wasted. The industrial, global, corporate food system is a non-relational food system. A relational food system is being an eater with an experience of standing in the middle of food, feeling yourself surrounded by food, by farms, farmers, forests, waters, cooks. You know, you have this feeling radiating out from you. And starting with one's own psychology, being in relationship with what your demands are around food, how we've gotten accustomed to food being so cheap. We spend the least percentage of our budget on food of any country in the world. So food is cheap for us. We abuse it. You know, we think, okay, I can eat a carton of ice cream. The only person it's going to hurt is me. So it's working with our psychology, our culture. What did I eat when I was growing up? What are my emotional associations with food? How does my body work? Having a relationship with the whole rubber tube between your mouth and your butt, and realizing that that's a whole colony that's digesting your food. So that's just the personal. And then you go out to your kitchen and realizing that the kitchen is the site of creativity. It's not the drudgery of, like, you know, just make 3 meals a day, you know, open a can of beans. And it's out to your yard, and it's out to the wild plants or the green plants, and it's the soil, and realizing that the soil is a living river of nutrients. It's minerals and microorganisms. And so you start to have this feeling that everything is alive. And food, eating, is the most intimate relationship I have. You know, there's only two orifices that we let anything in. And food we do three times a day, which the other one we don't use that often except for teenagers. So it is the most intimate contact we have with the world around us. We have this amazing tongue that can taste all these different varied tastes. We are designed to be a contiguous member of the natural world. So it is sort of a blissy feeling. It's a feeling of being tucked in and belonging to a place. And it's also a vulnerable feeling of realizing that if you sort of let go of the control system of the corporate industrial food system and make yourself vulnerable to the place you live, you have a huge commitment to that place flourishing, not out of some concept about, you know, I'm into sustainability and I want my place to blah, blah, blah. No, you have a visceral, literally a visceral experience of if I succeed, this place has to succeed.
Would you say more about how relational eating can make a difference for society as a whole?
That's a good question, and it is a question I asked myself. Is local food or relational eating, is this just something for hippies and yuppies? You know, that engaging with food in this way takes a little bit more to prepare. Sometimes, but it's not always. Sometimes it's more expensive. But I started to realize that once you fall in love with the place you live, and once you realize how grateful you are that there are farmers there who are growing this beautiful food, you realize that all is not well. You realize that the grocery store is like a stage set. It's like the back lot of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. It's the end point of an industrial system. That what's in that store is in that store thanks to the whole logistical process of getting food from someplace in the world to these shelves. It's not because it's been grown in your area. So you realize your vulnerability. Some studies in our region say 25% of our food we can source within our region. I doubt those numbers. I don't think it's that much. I think it's probably closer to 10% currently. It could be up to, you know, very large percent, but that would take a complete political, social engagement in transforming our food system. It goes right up against property rights. It goes right up against subsidies. It goes right up against transforming our food system, our regional food system, so that it could provide even 50% of the nutrition for the people who live here would change everything. So what happened for me with relational eating is I realized that a relational eater becomes committed to restoring the prosperity and abundance and productivity of the regional food shed, which includes not just the food that comes out of it, but the farmers who grow it and the soil it's grown in, and the whole life of the community.
You've alluded a bit to this, but during your experiment, the thought occurred to you that Whidbey Island would not be able to feed itself on local food. Would you like to say more about your thoughts around that issue?
As I was starting to wake up to this, you know, 3 days of food in the grocery store, I asked a local farmer, could we feed ourselves on Whidbey Island from Whidbey Island? And so she did a back-of-the-envelope calculation, number of people on the island, 2,000 calories a day, amount of land that's in agricultural zoning, things that grow well on Whidbey Island. You know, she really did a fairly thorough analysis of this. And she said, yeah, we could survive for 2 weeks in August. So it made me realize that my island, which is semi-rural, that you drive up the island and you see all these beautiful farms, that the farms are either hobby farms, somebody can buy 20 or 5 or 10 acres and put one horse on it, and it's their land and that's what they can do with it. You also see that there's a lot of food being produced that goes off island, that, you know, when there's somebody grows beets for beet seeds that are for off-island use. A lot of the land is used for hay, for animal feed. So you realize that the island is not arranged around feeding its people, where it was even 50, 60 years ago. Much more of the food was local food. We lost our dairies. We had quite a few dairies, and we lost them at a time when the price of milk was fixed, but the price of feed was fluctuating. And so the dairy farmers in our region, many of them went belly up in the same, like, two-year period. So you realize that even though it's a rural place, it's not arranged to produce the food, yet we have some of the most productive farmland on Whidbey Island, it's like Skagit Valley. We have farmland that at one time, 100 years ago, that it won the national prize of the tonnage of wheat that was taken off the land. So we have this capacity, but we're not socially and politically arranged to exploit it to feed ourselves. And when I thought about my 10-mile diet, I realized if 100 people decided to do a 10-mile diet, well, goodbye deer, goodbye bunnies, you know, I mean, goodbye nettles, goodbye, you know, chanterelles. If 100 people had to do what I was doing, we wouldn't have enough because we're not arranged around that value. But it's not inevitable that that happens. It's only how it's turned out, and we can change it.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Vicki Robin, author of the book Blessing the Hands That Feed Us, What Eating Closer to Home Can Teach Us About Food, Community, and Our Place on Earth. How do you see the local food systems interconnecting with the larger industrial food system?
Well, right now, the larger industrial food system edges out the local food system to a very large degree. Number one, they have strong lobbies, and so the playing field is tilted toward what they call vertical integration and consolidation of the market. There's four companies that grow most of our seed, and one of them being Monsanto, you know, is famous for pushing the edge of GMO seeds. And I'm not a rabid activist in making Monsanto the devil, but it is true that the dynamics of the corporate industrial system, whatever it's producing, it goes toward consolidation and vertical integration because that's where the profit is. A corporation's, as you well know, Diane, a corporation's primary goal is to make money for shareholders. It's not to feed the people. So that's how that system is designed to work. So it makes it much harder for small-scale farmers or mid-scale farmers to make enough money. And that becomes problematic because that's a cap on how much food can be grown in the region. Most people who farm have to have off-farm income. But we can change those laws. We can have cottage laws. We can take the onus of the kinds of regulations and licensing that's done for the large-scale producers. That can be made scale-appropriate regulations so the small-scale people don't have to pay the same fees as the large-scale people. We could have different outcome-based systems of confirming that produce and meat is wholesome to eat. We don't necessarily need the regulations of the USDA. We can monitor our own meat producers. There's many things that can be done. We could actually take some of the regulations off of raw milk, which is actually happening in many places. And there was a bill here in our area for that, where if you have a few goats or a cow or something like that, you can sell milk to your neighbors. So it's like disaggregating the industrial system that has a set of rules that is disadvantaging the local systems. And you can actually recognize, you could differentiate what kinds of rules and regulations and licensing and controls need to be put on a local system where people know each other. You're not going to poison your neighbor by selling them bad milk.
What else do you recommend to enhance local food systems?
Well, I think there's a lot that eaters can do. So far, we understand that what we can do is we can join a CSA, we could go to the farmer's market, we could go to farm stands. We understand we can buy organic. But we also can take it several steps further. We could actually ask our grocery stores. We could keep that pressure on, not in a hostile way, but ask the bulk produce person, you know, all this 500 different things that are there. Where does this come from? So we can ask more about the provenance, the sourcing of the food in the grocery store and put pressure on. I want to have more local produce in my store. But we can also, you know, we are all in a variety of social roles, like you're a radio talk show host. And so what you're doing right now by having me talk to you is an action of being a food system transformer because you're bringing out information from somebody who's thought a lot about it so that you can share it with other people, people who work in hospitals and schools. Everywhere you work, the ways you socialize, all of these are areas where we can influence the purchasing, the sharing, the cooking, talking about local food.
So what are the issues for scaling up of local food?
It's an interesting question because inherently local food can't scale up because it's local. But what I saw when I was doing this is it can scale sideways. The communities can develop what I call complementary food systems. It's not to eliminate the industrial system. We need the industrial system. Number one, because logistically it is feeding many people in the world, even though there's a lot of injustice in it. But, you know, you take people off of the industrial food system and you've got mass starvation. So we don't want to do that. We want to do a blended process of industrial food for when there's appropriate level of scale, perhaps like for grain production or field beans or certain things, or maybe the whole idea of comparative advantage, you know, in bananas or mangoes. But just think about our local systems and what we can produce locally. And what they call specialty crops, fruits and vegetables, are inherently fresher when they're local. So you think about complementary food systems where we're scaling sideways this capacity for communities to feed themselves, to put more land in agriculture, to support young and new farmers in prospering, to give loan guarantees and actual loans to young and new farmers, to subsidize several years like you might with a GI Bill. You do all of these things to fill out, bulk up, create more prosperity in your local system, all the while you are engaging with the industrial system in terms of food justice, in terms of sustainably harvested, in terms of all the values that you want to express through your global system that you can't see, touch, taste, and feel. But there's important things about creating those supply chains to be more sustainable and holistic.
You've been a proponent of frugality for many years. To what extent did buying locally and sustainably conflict with frugality?
That's a great question. One of the things that this 10-mile diet did for me was put me right up against that conflict. When I was out there looking for meat, somebody said, oh, I have a friend who harvested a bunch of chickens. You can buy a couple of chickens from him. And I thought, well, that's great. And I go over there and he's going to sell me two chickens. And I was very excited. And he said, I said, how much are they? And they were $25 a chicken. It was like $5 a pound. And I was like, oh, you just did it. You know, it was like I was a trapped animal. You know, like, what am I going to do here? I want that meat and I really want to bargain. I really want to figure out in some way this guy's going to give me that meat. But I realized, you know, it raised my consciousness about how much that person put into that animal being in his hands and available to me. The costs and the labor associated with that. And that actually that chicken should cost that. It should cost $5 a pound when you do the analysis. So the question for me wasn't, why is that chicken so expensive? The question was, why is industrial food so cheap? That's it sent me on that hunt. And, you know, I could say, and it's somewhat true, that I would pay anything to my local farmers for the food that they produce, just out of love. But it's not just that. It's not like I made a decision, I don't care how much it is, I'll pay that. It is respect for the whole process of growing, harvesting, bringing to market delicious, nutritious food, an appreciation for that that I realize my purchasing allows me to participate in. Now, mind you, I still procure food I really like, and it's not local, and I'm not ideological about it. But when people ask me, oh, are you still doing it? Yes, I'm a relational eater through and through. I love eating the food that's produced by people I know now, people who are my neighbors. And that feeling, that warm feeling of being fully connected is totally worth it to me. And the other part of it, too, is that once you get off the idea, I think Your Money, Your Life helped people see themselves as an individual who could extract themselves from the thrall of the consumer culture and make better judgments about what's actually worth it to purchase. But it was a very individualistic strategy. Now, this book is really about a social strategy. It's not about an individual maximizing their dollars. It's about a person in community recognizing that if I want a grocery store in my community, I'm going to buy food from that grocery store. Maybe it is 10 cents a pound more, but in the grand scheme of things, I need the grocer to prosper if the grocer is going to feed me. It's understanding myself in a context.
It's highly values-based. It is a survival thing, you know, just like your money, your life is a survival thing. But it's realizing that one does not survive by oneself. When you start to get into the whole idea of sustainability, you realize the unit of sustainability is not the individual. The unit of sustainability is a community that's flourishing. And so it's participating in that. One small part of my participation is buying my whatever at my local grocery store and eating less. That's the other part of it, is I realize what a high quality food meat is, not just because it's a mammal that was killed and butchered, but also because there's a huge amount that's gone into the production of that. You know, it's different from a mushroom you go and forage in the forest. And so I eat meat as a treat, not as a meal. And that's really been a shift for me. I think I eat a quarter of or third of the meat I used to eat, not out of ideology, but out of respect for the quality of that particular food. So one of the ways I managed my frugality was I thought, well, I'll buy the $5 a pound chicken and I'll eat half. I turned it into a frugal chicken by adjusting my habits, not to the point where I feel deprived, but to a point where I feel it's all in proportion.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think it's a message of engagement, that there's benefits to engaging in local food far beyond the ones that are always presented, that it's fresher, it's healthier, et cetera, but to engage in it as a person in community, to engage in local food as, in a way, it's an act of not just food security, like if we have more local food, then we're more food secure, but it's food sovereignty. It's like taking back, we the eaters, reclaiming our right to grow and feed food for ourselves and our family, and to do that economically, and to do that abundantly. It's like participating in actually a very quiet revolution that is growing like an amoeba in our society. It's growing, some of it top down with some regulations that help us, but a lot of it's laterally, people figuring out things at the margins. It's hugely creative to be part of restoring our regional food systems. I would invite people, adopt a food, you know, just one local food, one recipe that you make with all local ingredients. Grow sprouts on your windowsill. Do something to step into this world and become part of it, and then see what happens.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Vicki.
You're so welcome, Diane.
You are just listening to Vicki Robin, author of the book Blessing the Hands That Feed Us, What Eating Closer to Home Can Teach Us About Food, Community, and Our Place on Earth, published in 2014 by Viking. For more information, check on the web at VickiRobin.com. Vicki will read from her book in Seattle on Monday, January 13th at 7 p.m. at Elliott Bay Book Company. Again, that's January 13th at 7 p.m. at Elliott Bay Books. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.